I will now pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, who will open up today's call.
Thank you, Megan, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for joining us today. As Megan already stated, I'm Jennifer Hanna. I'm the Director of the Office of Healthcare Readiness here at ASPR. Before I hand it over to our first presenter, I would like to provide a brief overview of what we will cover today. Next slide, please. So today's meeting focus is on emergency medical services, or EMS, and pre-hospital care. I will begin by providing a few updates relating to ASPR's healthcare readiness programs. Next, Rachel Lehman, the Acting Director of ASPR Tracy, will provide an overview of ASPR Tracy's pre-hospital care and EMS-related resources. Afterwards, Dr. Richard C. Hunt, the Senior Medical Advisor for the Office of Healthcare Readiness, will lead a panel discussion on pre-hospital care. Finally, we will leave some time at the end for general questions for all of you. Next slide, please. I'd like to begin today with a few administrative updates. Just a reminder, hopefully you will refer to the healthcare readiness bulletin that was published or released on Monday. Please refer to the bulletin for any upcoming recipient webinars, as well as any upcoming performance measures, deadlines, if you would. Next slide, please. Thank you, Megan. We recently published new healthcare readiness stories from the field. Stories from the field, of course, highlight your hard work and accomplishments. From New York City to Arizona, these new stories are examples of the diversity of support that ASPR funding offers you and your subrecipients as you bolster emergency preparedness and response. To read these stories and to explore others, head to the Stories from the Field page on aspr.hhs.gov. For your reference, a member of our team will share the Stories from the Field page link in the chat. I will now pass it over to Rachel to provide an overview of ASPR Tracy's pre-hospital care resources. Rachel?
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you for featuring ASPR Tracy on today's All Recipient webinar. It is always such a privilege to present on these calls. Next slide. As Jennifer said, I'm going to give you a quick overview of ASPR Tracy's pre-hospital resources. As you can see, we have developed a wide variety of resources with our subject matter experts in response to and in anticipation of incidents. Next slide. ASPR Tracy created the EMS Infectious Disease Playbook in 2017, and since its release, it has become one of our most popular resources, and we comprehensively updated the playbook early this summer. The goal of this document is to unify multiple resources of information in a single concise planning document addressing the full spectrum of infectious agents for EMS agencies developing their service policies. The first section covers dispatch and responder actions and includes a screening and on-scene assessment algorithm. The rest of the playbook is organized by precaution, such as contact, droplet, and airborne. The last section covers special considerations such as hand hygiene, pandemic-specific precautions, pediatric issues, and occupational health. Next slide. The Paradigms and Pitfalls document was created to help EMS medical directors and EMS system planners and hospital emergency planners plan for mass violence events where the scene is dynamic, the number of patients far exceeds the usual resources, and the usual triage and treatment paradigms may fail. It focuses more on the principles of triage versus the actual process, including doing the greatest good for the greatest number of patients with the resources available, gaining rapid access to living casualties and evaluating them from the hazard area, providing basic life-saving interventions as soon as it is safe to do so, transporting the injured to the appropriate hospital as rapidly as possible, when necessary, prioritizing resources to those who are most in need and are salvageable with current resources, and re-triaging patients as the resource situation continues to change over time. Moving forward, the Mass Violence and Active Shooter Incidents Tip Sheet is part of a suite of mass violence tip sheets ASPR Tracy created after the Las Vegas Harvest Festival shooting. In this tip sheet, we provide EMS providers with pre-event considerations, steps to take during the initial response to a mass casualty incident, and how to transition to supporting hospitals once patient transport is complete. Next slide. We are in the process of having subject matter experts comprehensively review our two updated pre-hospital topic collections, the pre-hospital collection and the pre-hospital mass casualty triage and trauma care collection. As you can see, while they share some of the same categories, these collections differ in both in scope and focus. We'll be releasing the updated versions of these in September, so keep an eye on your inboxes. Next slide. And then I wanted to give you a quick overview of some of our recent releases. So in addition to version 2.0 of the EMS Infectious Diseases Playbook, we've released some additional resources this summer you all may be interested in. The Lessons Learned in Healthcare Communications article is based on a roundtable Ask for Tracy hosted in spring 2023, which featured speakers representing a wide range of healthcare stakeholders and jurisdiction types, sharing how they integrated lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic and recent incidents into current and future responses. Topics covered in the article include channels used for outreach and continued engagement, strategies for reaching different community and cultural groups, tracking and countering rumors, and working with partners to create complementary messaging. The Health Equity Job Action Sheet is modeled after the Hospital Incident Command System job action sheets. Healthcare planners can tailor this job action sheet to their system to incorporate a dedicated health equity officer position. We also recently recorded a presentation moderated by the California Department of Public Health, featuring panelists from public health departments and healthcare systems in California, sharing their experiences with preparedness and response efforts for planned and unplanned power disruptions. We released another speaker series recording recently, which was a demo of our mass casualty hospital capacity expansion toolkit. And that toolkit itself was actually released this spring. Lastly, we added air quality resources to our climate change and healthcare system considerations topic collection. And we updated our healthcare facility onboarding checklists and our solar eclipse planning resources documents. Next slide. And please just never hesitate to reach out to Ask for Tracy's Assistance Center. We are here to provide you personalized technical assistance and answer your questions. And that is all I have for today, unless anyone has any questions.
Thank you, Rachel. And just as a reminder for everyone, if you have a question, please certainly enter it into the chat feature here in Zoom, or you can raise your hand and ask your question live. Thanks for that overview, Rachel.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, good afternoon.
I was going to say, so I'm not seeing any questions in the chat or anyone raising their hand. So we'll now pass it over to Dr. Richard Hunt.
Shoot, Jennifer, I wasn't even going to wait. So my name is Richard Hunt. I'm the senior medical advisor for the Office of Healthcare Readiness here at ASPR. For today's panel discussion, we've invited individuals that represent the federal, state, and local levels of pre-hospital care. I'm joined by Dr. Carol Cunningham, the State Medical Director for the Ohio Department of Public Safety EMS Division, Terry Kramer, the Chief of Disaster Response at the LA County, Los Angeles County EMS Agency, and Kate Elkins, an EMS and 911 specialist from the United States Department of Transportation's National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's Office of EMS Services. We're really excited to have each of you on the call today. Appreciate that. And we're looking forward to hearing your unique perspectives and experience in pre-hospital care. While we're getting the panel set up here, I'm going to start by going over the logistics for this panel discussion. For the panelists, I will read each discussion question and invite one of you to start the conversation. And feel free to add on to what another panelist had shared, even if you've already spoken. For those of you in the audience, please enter any questions in the chat during the panel. We hope to address questions time dependent in the QA portion of today's panel. For the purposes of today's discussion, let's talk about EMS broadly to encompass 911. Kate, you got that? EMS response to medical emergencies, calls to 911 and those EMS agencies' response, and interfacility, air and ground medical transport, including non-critical care and critical care interfacility transport. So broad spectrum. With that in mind, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to start by discussing EMS membership and representation in our Office of Healthcare Readiness's programs. We have a number of programs in our office, and what really want to address and discuss that membership and representation by EMS. EMS is a key partner and member for several of our ASPR healthcare readiness programs and activities. For example, the Hospital Preparedness Program, which supports healthcare coalitions, and the Regional Disaster Health Response System require EMS to be a core member. And additionally, medical transport of special pathogens requires EMS to be at the table for sure. However, we've seen that there's an underrepresentation and inconsistent involvement of EMS organizations for a variety of reasons, including variation in EMS structures throughout the nation. So the first question, and teeing this up, Kate, you're going to go first with this one. Have you seen any opportunities or noted practices that could really address the challenges or barriers for EMS to participate and collaborate in healthcare preparedness and emergency response programs that we have? And from your experience, what are the challenges and barriers that you've seen for EMS to participate and collaborate in these kinds of programs?
Excellent question. Well, EMS and 911 systems grew up locally and regionally, and at the state level, they're regulated that way. So sometimes it can be really complicated to get their engagement, especially in pre-planning. When your hair's on fire and you have a whole million things to do in the current moment, it's hard to step aside and go to meetings for planning. So I think one of the strategies that I would strongly recommend that people participate in is start with your state offices. Engage those state offices who understand the complexity and the nuance of the local and the regional systems within your state, and engage for that partnership to really leverage the resources that they bring to bear within your community, within your region, within your state, and then have them help you to build those critical relationships early to engage, recruit, and have participation in all phases of this engagement.
Thanks, Kate. Terry, your perspective on this.
Yeah, as Kate mentioned, I think it all starts down to, you know, reaching out to different agencies. You know, I can only give you a perspective of what we do in Los Angeles County, which I understand does not apply to some other areas. But strategies we've used is we have basically a pre-hospital policy manual, which dictates how things are done in the pre-hospital environment. And with that, we have different collaborative groups that we've had for over 40 years, which are a provider agency group, an LA County area ambulance group, a hospital group, pediatric group, et cetera. And we engage them based on that specialty and that expertise. And so we engage them at that level, but also because you know, of our size and complexity of our county of 4,000 square miles and 10 million people, trying to eat an elephant all at once is very challenging. So we broke up our county into 9 different what we call disaster resource regions. And we have a hub and spoke model where we can make the fire department that is a little bit smaller in a smaller community feel like they have better engagement from a local level versus looking at this big complex system we call LA County. So they engage at those more regional, local levels to make it more pertinent how they have an impact on their community that many of them live in and serve versus looking at a bigger picture of LA County where they may not see that value because of our size.
Thanks, Terry. Especially appreciate like sort of like the LA County, it's local, but it's big local. Carol, how about you from a state EMS medical director perspective? What's stopping people from being engaged?
Well, I think it starts out with an invitation. I can tell you when I started, a lot of the other departments in Ohio didn't even know there was a state EMS medical director. And I just went out and it kind of introduced myself. But, you know, 20 years later, it is so much better. I think that it's as Kate mentioned, you have to have a strong relationship with your state EMS office, but it's a two-way street. I really cringe when we're like invited to a project as an afterthought. EMS really should be on the ground floor of every planning initiative. And the EMS, with the committees you have within your EMS agency, you should at least invite the folks from public health, mental health, whatever you need at the table. And likewise, since we've done that, it's a two-way street. We're invited now to many of the critical committees, again, at the ground level with our healthcare response agencies. One new thing that we have is we now have, just started this summer, a state agency medical directors forum. So all the medical directors, whether it's mental health or whatever, we get together once a month. And it's amazing kind of the shared troubles and solutions that we come up with.
Yeah, I think the clip from the news feed on this would be, it starts with an invitation. I like that. I appreciate that, Carol. I really do.
Yeah, have an open door policy.
Yeah. Next question. How, from your perspective, I mean, we have recipients of our Office of Healthcare Readiness awards, okay? So, you know, the Regional Disaster Health Response System, Hospital Preparedness Program supporting coalitions, and then again, medical transport of special pathogen patients as an additional area. And so how, beyond the invitation, and I think you've provided a really good perspective, so it's sort of like that state, and then again, local, Terry's comments, so forth. How do you think we can specifically, in addition to doing an invitation, improve recruitment? And I'm not talking about recruitment of paramedics and EMT. I'm talking about recruitment of EMS agencies, their representation and inclusion in EMS in our planning and emergency response in these specific programs. Let me start with Terry on that. Terry?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And one of the things is the challenge, I believe, is that, you know, you look at the healthcare perspective and you have a lot of regulatory bodies, right? You have a Joint Commission, you have CMS, you have a lot of people that hold us accountable to do engagement. And that's kind of how you look at a lot of ESF8. But when you look at ESF4, which in our system, all our 911 are fire-based. So it's a little bit of a different challenge because what is their regulatory body? I don't know. And that's kind of the point. They got the National Highway Traffic Safety. You have some others, but they're not regulatory. They're kind of more guidance type of things, right? You see NHTSA there. So that's a challenge right there because their mission and our mission are kind of incongruent, and to try to get them to see the collaboration ahead of time. And we never have issues in the response phase, right? We actually, everybody buckles down and helps each other. But in that planning stage, you know, they're worried about fires. They're worried about other things that have not necessarily healthcare. And so, again, I present it as, you know, a prize. There's a participation thing. We participate in their drills. We invite them to our drills. There's a regulatory piece that we don't always want to force people to do things, but there are benefits to some regulatory that basically at a local EMS level that you have to do some. So one of the things we've done with our ambulances, if they want that exclusive operating to get that transport contract, they're basically signing up that you will be helping in a disaster to move patients and you're going to be participating in meetings to plan for those types of disasters. So there was a regulatory piece, incentivizing, looking at things that benefit them. During COVID, if you were engaged with us on these meetings, there was, we had a better understanding of what your need was for PPE. So there was a prize there. If you participated, you could give us a better idea of what the situation was for your department, so that you may get a higher percentage of the PPE that was being distributed, because now we had an idea. And if you weren't engaged, then obviously we didn't know that. And then I think the key for us is it's a two-pronged approach. You know, you have this at a local level, engaging at that smaller captain, maybe battalion chief level, by participating in those regional type of meetings that I discussed a little earlier. But then there's also engagement with the chiefs, the big chiefs, the assistant chiefs, the department chiefs. So engaging that leadership and approaching it from the ground member, worker bee, boots on the ground person, seeing what the benefit is to know what's going on locally, but then also from a systems approach from the high level to get their buy-in that this is important. You can't just do one or the other, because the boots on the ground may feel it's important, but they haven't had that engagement with the higher leadership, which may not see it's important. So that's going to take executives at the CEO level, at a hospital, EMS level, public health level, high leadership, engaging with the chiefs, because the chiefs aren't engaging with just the regular emergency manager. They're going to want to engage at that high executive level. So those are things that have worked for us and seem to have benefited us, especially in big responses like train derailments and earthquakes and recently hurricanes. So that's what I have.
Hey, Terry, you know, you bring up some really important points for all of us. I mean, LA County being fire-based, I can name a city on the East Coast that's very fire-based, like New York City. So it's, I think it's important you pointed out, it's not just like one size fits all in EMS, it's volunteers, it's privates, it's fire-based, and probably more. That provides a challenge. Yet I reflect back on Carol's comment about you have to have an invitation and what's the prize. I mean, what incentivizes somebody to actually be there, part of the rhetorical question, not for you to answer, but is better planning and the potential to actually improve our building capacity to save lives and continue to operate, is that sufficient, or is there something a near tangible that you need for the planning piece? And I don't know the answer to that, but it's
let me give you one example of an incentivation too, is we get HPP funding. We have a healthcare coalition. So if you're part of that coalition, one of the things that we've tried to do is break out some of that money that's not just hospital based. So we learned a lesson from Vegas shooting. One of the ambulance companies threw out tourniquets in a disorganized way, but it was organized in the sense that they knew that there was military personnel, off-duty police officers, off-duty fire and Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, for crying out loud, that knew how to apply tourniquets. So what they did is just threw them out there randomly and let them do their thing, instead of having people take off their belts and shirts to make these improvised tourniquets. So the incentive now is we're working on a project where we're going to create these, what we call trauma throw bags, that will be on supervisor vehicles. So we're engaging that leadership. We're engaging the Joe Blow paramedic boots on the ground guy, who's allowed to now throw a bag out in the crowd and let other people in the community do what they know best. I mean, there's a lot of nurses off duty, and I always feel like, you know, my hands are tied in some of these because I don't have my tools. I have the knowledge of what to do, but I don't have the tools with me. So this will help provide the tool to those people that know how to use them out there. And so that's an incentive, because it now doesn't have their budget, right? We're providing that outside of their budget. So that's just one example that can try to help incentivize.
Thanks, Terry. And since that
event, this really big package on my front porch. She was there yesterday, and it's your dad's.
Somebody covers. Got to mute their mic there. Thanks. So, you know, Terry, since that event, now there are 3 million people in the United States, members of the public, trained in bleeding control. So it's not what we had at Las Vegas. It's better. How about Carol? Any perspectives from you on this? Terry, I really appreciate your comments there.
Yeah, sure. I think that
again, opening the table, making people feel valued. In Ohio, we have fire-based EMS, we have private EMS, but we also have a significant, like a third of the state that's served by rural and volunteer agencies. And I think I've always told them, you know, they're a valuable asset because they are our link to the community. When you look at the different response patterns, you know, everybody wants to live. So regardless of what kind of assets are available, it's a community that's going to come up with and use the resources that they have and come up with a solution. But again, you know, I look at the state office, like, what can we do to help? I think in our committees, we actually make an active effort to make sure we have representation from a volunteer EMS agency or rural EMS agency, because you can't have the big cities running everything. It just doesn't work that way. I remember I was appalled when Kempac came out, and there were some assets that could be distributed. And then there was a program where people could actually get antidotes outside of Kempac, and they were supposed to distribute them throughout the Homeland Security Agency. And I had them one metropolitan area, which I won't name. You know, one of the guys was just like, where's ours? Oh, we'll just bring it to you. Well, you know, the toxin killed everybody, would be dead by then. And that's the kind of you know, control that we and mindset that we have to get rid of. And, you know, again, like I said, you need to not be so prescriptive with the plans. And the other important link, I think, that I need to mention is a lot of these areas, we border on other states. And when there's a mass casualty event, does the patient really care, you know, which level of provider, who's intubating them? They need an airway. So we need to work together and make sure that we're both familiar with the variations and scopes of practice and create disaster plans, again, that are going to mesh well for the client who is our patient.
Thanks, Carol. Hey, Kate, anything to add?
I just want to echo, I love Dr. Cunningham's remarks about don't neglect the volunteers in the rural communities. I think it's really important when you're engaging with EMS, they don't have the same healthcare center corporate culture, or they don't have the same work hours necessarily. And if you really want them to engage, you need to make it something that they can engage. Make it something where they can physically get there. Make it so that there are virtual options, if the virtual options will work for them. Make it also something where they recognize the benefit and participation. And I mean that from the sense of, if they have engaged in the past and then were summarily ignored or not considered or their input wasn't taken in, why are they going to invest their most valuable resource, which is their time and energy, in your project or in your program? And I think it's really important that we have their engagement, because there are a lot of assumptions that are made. And when you get to the response time, you want to make sure that you're not working on an assumption that isn't valid per se. I know during COVID, we had a lot of challenges where EMS, and especially volunteer EMS and rural EMS, was stepping up and filling a lot of safety net features for their communities. And, you know, when the volunteer agency in your rural community has two ambulances, one's for 911 and one sometimes is staffed to do interfacility, and all of a sudden they've reached a point where they're no longer staffing that second ambulance, but that second ambulance is critical to your hospital decompression of a critical access hospital. Everybody in that community now has a problem. So making sure the invitation is there, that they can make it to the table, that they feel like they can speak up and be engaged at the table, is incredibly important.
Thanks, Kate. Carol, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I'll just add on to what Kate mentioned. An example also is bringing, if there is something that they need to know, take it to them. Don't wait for them to come to you. You know, we had a issue with like pediatric intubations, how often do they get to intubate? Well, a couple of years ago, we got all the pediatric hospitals together, and we had teams that actually went out and went to them. A volunteer can't take off from work, doesn't have the resources to go to a big conference. And again, I think it really made them feel valued, and it helped their community. Because in that scenario, that's a hot topic. You gotta know what you're doing on something that you don't do very often.
Great examples, and I really appreciate that. It's like, it's not banker's hours for especially for UMass. It is for the hospital too, but they can still have the 9 to 5 people come and represent and so forth, so on. So it's good point. Good points. Next set of questions. There's a couple questions. They're related to medical surge, and EMS indeed plays a really critical role in mitigating surge, defined as events where healthcare entities care for an increased volume of patients exceeding normal operating capacity. All of us on this, the entire nation saw a medical surge, so it's not new to us. Realizing the differing capabilities and capacities for EMS at state and local levels, as well as between urban, rural, and frontier communities. A first question would be, from where each of you sit, what are the critical capabilities you see EMS bringing to the table to help with patient movement and load balancing of patients during surge? And then what are the challenges you see that are preventing EMS from supporting medical surge today? Realizing today is different than not so long ago, actually. How about we go with Carol first on that?
Okay. This is a great topic. I think that we're using telehealth more, but we also have to trust our EMS providers. Just because you call 911 doesn't mean that you need an ambulance. Just because you not call 911 doesn't mean that you need a hospital. For the folks on the ground, they need us to set up, other care areas or resources where we're really focusing on taking true emergencies that need to be at the hospital there, but also giving resources to people that we decide to shelter in place or to send them to an urgent care. Or like during blackout 2003, people just needed electricity. We opened up a high school gym and, anybody who needed oxygen generators were plugged in. In terms of barriers, I think that some of the legislation can put people in trouble. I love states that have crisis standard of care plans where they get additional liability protection for making these type of decisions. If you live in a litigious state, that can really be a scary thing. As any type of patient refusal, as you know, Dr. Hunt, it can be dicey. But again, with telehealth, we can use that as a resource. And then I also think that there just needs to be, how do I put it? Particularly in the volunteer areas, just make sure that your scope of practice is being utilized in the most efficient way. When you don't have paramedics and people still need naloxone, yeah, they need it, but what can the state do to help? One thing that we did is we made an agreement with the drug companies that we could get wholesale prices for naloxone, again, to increase access so that EMRs who can't start IVs or use other routes can still go ahead and save these overdose patients. There's a lot, the world's our oyster. We just have to, think about barriers and get rid of them.
Carol, you point out, at least make me think about the extraordinary adaptability of EMS and doing some really hard problem solving during COVID, and examples that we saw, administration of monoclonal antibody. I mean, a lot of the telemedicine piece, and then trying to figure out how to like stay alive and what stay alive, how I'm using that because I saw an article of a quote about EMS recently about staying alive, EMS staying alive. The challenges that some of the regulations have we're confronted with that make it really difficult for us to respond to medical surges in ways that we might otherwise. How about you, Kate? Your thoughts on this?
So excellent points, Dr. Cunningham. And I think that what's really important is we are in the community for the community. We are that safety net system for the everyday. And when there is a crisis or an emergency, we oftentimes are just asked to rise to that situation. And I would highlight that your 911 center and your emergency medical dispatchers are key components to managing surge, empowering not just your EMS clinicians, but your emergency medical dispatchers through your medical director to be able to follow protocols. And how many of these calls can go to nurse triage? How many can go to telehealth? How many can have a delayed response? Maybe your community paramedics or mobile integrated healthcare team can step in and do some of this work in collaboration with your local primary care, urgent care, and other alternate destinations. How can we, on the front end, really using these clinicians who are in our communities, leverage their expertise? They practice at the intersection of public health, public safety, emergency management, and healthcare every day. How can we leverage that expertise and empower them to be that frontline provider we need and reduce the number of unnecessary trips into that hospital system? And then making sure that they're taking those patients who do need to go to the right place, empowering them not only through protocol and clinical expertise and training, but we're going to have to talk about that elephant in the room, which is finances. And the ability to actually pay for that kind of care, which we know that our system can do, but it currently very much struggles to fund or be reimbursed for. So when we're thinking about planning, are we planning so that we can actually leverage all of that expertise? Or have we still pigeonholed EMS as patient transport? And we're not necessarily thinking about them as the ability to get vaccinations into our communities, into our senior centers, or that, you know, tribal nation that actually used their paramedics and home health care to do antibody infusions of elders without moving them from their homes. Leveraging those opportunities to care where our patients are in our communities with cultural competence is incredibly valuable. And I think it's going to be important that we have the engagement of our state EMS offices, of all of our medical directors, to empower them to do this amazing healthcare that they're able to do, but also working on those regulatory challenges. You know, county lines, state lines shouldn't be a barrier, especially in a crisis, but nor should financial systems for reimbursement. And so that's something that's really challenging, and I don't have a solution. I'm just pointing it out as a challenge.
Hey. Must be hard because nobody's been able to unlock that one for decades. So don't feel alone with it. Carol, a quick comment.
And then Real quick.
Over to Carol. Yeah.
She brought up a point. We really also have to educate our community. I'd encourage everybody to go to the Division EMS website. We created, early in the pandemic, my own fire chief called me and said, we're getting killed with calls. And we produced a part of the solution video that we put out on the TV as a public service agency announcement that educated the community on what kind of symptoms really needed to go to the hospital. But we also in that video showed the community everything the EMS had to do to get the vehicle ready. They got to see how it got cleaned, and it wasn't like you just drive and go back. And it really, really had a positive impact on making people think about what's appropriate.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. Educating the community is huge. challenge, especially with the numbers of people we have, or lack of numbers, but hugely important. Terry, how about your perspective? I'm familiar with some of the things that LA County did during the pandemic, EMS did with reference to surge, but want to hear your perspectives on this.
Well, I'm not going to repeat what Kate and Carol said. I think they brought up very valid points that I concur with. One of the things I'd like to kind of highlight what Kate was pointing out is, you know, when Medicare and Medicaid haven't increased their rates since 1998, that makes it very challenging for small EMS departments that are not fire-based to continue operating. And as I heard one of my colleagues say that works in the ambulance industry, if we're not transporting, we're not making money. And so to engage them on this, looking at the challenges, I like to emphasize in supporting preparedness, it's not that they don't want to support preparedness. They just don't have the luxury of having additional funds to attend meetings when they're not getting paid to do that. And they have to be out in the field. And when they are out in the field, they're getting pennies to the dollar on what it's actually costing them for a variety of reasons. I don't want to get into all the politics of, you know, living wages and everything else. But, you know, I have heard, you know, EMTs say, you know, it's hard to work for a company where you put your life on the line, go in code three, expose yourselves to individuals that are ill, maybe contagious, and you're making only $2 more than the guy that works at McDonald's on an hourly basis. That's the kind of challenges our EMS providers are facing from the private sector. The fire sector has a little bit better because obviously they're public funded and they have a little bit more resources in those funding streams. So our fire side having those challenges is a little less because they do get paid to attend meetings. They do get paid to come to that because that's part of their work environment is to interact with us as an EMS agency, to follow procedures and protocols and to be part of the solutions that we come up with. So, but I can see the private sector versus the public sector. And obviously for those areas around the country that have volunteers, that just compounds it. I mean, they're doing it from their heart, not because of any financial gain that's going to come from it. So I think there's pros and cons to all these different types of EMS providers. So, again, I won't echo because I do concur with everything they said about the question that was challenged. Those are just my additions. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. I think some of the we've touched on some of what would have been responses to the fourth question. So I'm going to go sort of cut to the chase and go to the last question. The last question is, with the diminished number of EMTs and paramedics as compared to pre-pandemic levels, how can EMS adapt to best respond to the wide range and severity of disasters that we are facing? So I'm going to start with Terry.
Of course you would. this is probably the most challenging question of today, right? Because again, recruitment of EMTs, we have plenty of schools. We're just seeing enrollment down. And again, it's because of, you know, people do their research and go, well, this is how much I make. This is how much I'm not going to make. Some do it because it's a stepping stone. So this is a challenge we're still facing with. I don't have a clear answer to this. It's because, and then looking at LA County, we have some, how do I put this nicely? We have challenges from our public health, which a county right next door has a different operating picture. And I'm just going to use it. There's mandates for vaccines and masks and certain things that we may be facing in our county under certain situations, but a county next door isn't requiring the same thing. So we're losing our EMTs to other counties because of personal beliefs or about, say, these COVID mandates. So that's been a challenge for us because we're surrounded where people have the opportunity to make choices, and their choices, we're going to go somewhere where there's not as much government influence on what dictates what it requires for me to be an EMT in this county. At the same time, like I said, when you have pay of people that are doing I, you know, in some opinions, maybe less critical work and are almost making comparably the same amount of money, it makes it more challenging to recruit people when there's no financial benefit with a little bit maybe higher risk. And quite honestly, you know, more training. I mean, EMTs and paramedics, there's quite an extensive amount of training that goes into, you know, do what they do. And not everybody's altruistic that they're going to come out there and do it for free or at a decreased rate because they got to put food on the table and feed their families too. So, this is a challenge. And I'd love to hear my colleagues on the panel hear what their approach has been to this.
Hey, Terry, you know, you're talking about like the recruitment challenges and so forth. And yet from what I'm hearing, it's like, this is not like, in 2 months' time, we're going to like have the same workforce levels. So how you adapt, but you actually, in your very first response, the very first question I threw out there, well, maybe it wasn't the first, but you talked about that Las Vegas thing where they had throw kits and they threw kits out to the public. And so in many ways, that's sort of like a microcosm of this, we don't have enough to respond to this. So they leveraged sort of a force multiplier and a really, you know, it was the first time I heard of it. First time I think maybe many of us have heard of it, but it was pretty effective. So, I mean, I think you actually answered part of the question in one of your earlier responses. Kate, how about you?
Well, I'm going to shout out to North Dakota training ranchers in remote parts of the state with the basics of naloxone administration, stop the bleed, and CPR, giving them some AEDs. Force multipliers when you don't have a lot of ambulances, don't have enough volunteers, et cetera. Thinking outside of the box, how can you get your community education and engagement to buy you time to get there? I think that's important. So I am a volunteer paramedic. I still volunteer. I still respond to calls. And how do you keep people once you have them? What are you doing for retention? What are you doing for their mental health? What are we doing to manage the stressors that we can manage that are like interpersonal, operational challenges in a department? How do we manage the challenge of when I was paying for grad school as a paramedic years ago, it would actually have been financially beneficial to work at a different venue. I would have made more money. How do we overcome some of those challenges? But another thing that's really important is we had to shut down the educational pipeline during COVID for a period of time. A lot of our training programs still struggle to get clinical hours in hospital settings. How can we engage public health, healthcare, emergency management, and public safety partners to shore up and give us the support that we need to make sure that our educational system is thriving, that when we do recruit people, we're able to retain them? I would love for us to have really, really robust mental health resources for all first responders, but that's a passion of mine. I think it's also really important that just because somebody's volunteering and they're not doing it for money doesn't mean that they don't have a reason that's investing them in doing it. How do we harness those people who are doing it because it's their community or doing it because their family could be the ones calling? How do we recognize some of those driving factors and find out how do we recruit more of those people? It's not as often now that we're seeing people having the time to volunteer, because they have to have two jobs just to put food on the table, or you have to have multiple things. So I think it's a really complicated situation, but I would call out that things we can do easily is facilitating the educational system and supporting them. Maybe thinking about regulation in the federal space, you know, you can't take out student loans necessarily for a paramedic program. Why isn't that? Why don't we have some of those opportunities there? So thinking through how can we make it easier for our communities to train people at all levels, not just the highest level, and how do we find the right people who want to do the work and engage them to stay?
Yeah, thanks, Kate. One quick question for you, Kate. From what you're hearing in the office of EMS, are you hearing an increase in young people coming in, or not yet, or not really right now?
I think it really depends on where you are. Okay. There are some regions, some places, some locales that are doing really great. I have a colleague in a rural ambulance service that had two brand new people walk in. She's like, I didn't have to chase them down. They walked right in my doors. Yeah. And joined my department. But I think, and you know, there's a community in Alaska that is doing a remote AEMT course for their community, and they don't have a hospital. So, you know, those places, it's really important. I think in some ways we need to take a lesson from positive psychology. How do we look at the outliers that are positive? Not the doom and gloom outliers where we're losing catastrophic numbers of our workforce to other fields because they can make more money, but why are you retaining your people? How are you keeping your people in some of these places that are more challenged? And I'm optimistic that we'll learn something from that. I will say we are hearing concerning things about agencies shutting down or volunteer departments where the volunteers are significantly older than would make you comfortable for succession planning. Yeah. And even where I volunteer, you know, there is a challenge of not only getting the volunteers to come in, but what do you do with the person who's 25 and doesn't drive a car? How do you get those ambulances moving if your volunteers don't actively drive yet? So there's going to be a lot of things that we're going to have to address.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. Well said. Carol, I think you get the final word on this one.
Gosh, so much to be said. You know, my biggest fear this isn't just happening in EMS, it's happening in all medical professions. We also have most experienced people retiring and leaving earlier doing non-patient care. So we have to really ramp it up to make sure we have quality leadership in the future. I think that we really need to create EMS scholarships. People get scholarships to go to college. Why do they not get scholarships to be EMS providers? We often look at how do we get more paramedics. Let's not forget about the EMR level. We can get people exposed to EMS and, you know, start out as an EMR, then go to EMT school. I'm doing a lot of, we have an EMT program for high school kids. They get college credit through the paramedic program that I'm the medical director for. It's a local community college, and that's very attractive. And it doesn't cost them anything. We went to the community and they actually funded that. And then the one thing that Kate mentioned, and I was only able to convince, I was only able to do it at one school, but during COVID, when everybody was, you know, doing their education virtually and not doing their clinical time, we have to always remember medicine is a people business. I went to our dean and, you know, the school was shut down. I said, it doesn't have to be mandatory, but for those kids who want to come out, the paramedics are giving mass vaccinations anyway. As long as there's a paramedic with them, why not have the student come out and be part of it? Not only is that increasing the manpower, but we've got, you know, kids coming out that weren't alive during 9/11. They don't know the satisfaction it gives to be part of the solution, part of that team. And I can tell you the students who participated, they loved it. The paramedics who were doing the vaccination clinics, they loved it too because they had more manpower. And again, you know, you can't teach compassion through a computer. You know, sometimes you got to hold somebody's hand, and that's the best medicine that they could have. So I think we need to work on that, make it attractive. But really, finances is big. There's no reason why somebody should have to go to school and not be offered a scholarship when you can get a full ride playing basketball and doing something else.
Yeah, and seeing on that, your example of the experience of being gratified by being part of the solution. At least in my experience, I spent more time with patients in the field as an EMT per patient than I ever did as a physician in an emergency department. Just like actual time spent, and extraordinarily gratifying. I really appreciate the input from you, Carol, Kate, and Terry. You've been great panelists with a lot of great insights from really very different perspectives. You know, the national office, Office of EMS, and then Carol with the state, and Terry, wow, LA County, goodness. So I really appreciate your input. And hopefully, I mean, some of those who've been on this call really have benefited in some really specific, but also general ways about how we can do a much better job of incorporating EMS into our programs here at the Office of Healthcare Readiness. So with that, for those who are on the call, feel free to submit questions or comments. I think there have been some already. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to our office director, Jennifer Hanna.
Thanks, Rick. And I want to certainly thank our panelists. I mean, what a great discussion. I think I would describe that as wow, wow, wow. Three times over. So certainly, as Rick has stated, you know, this is an opportunity for any of our attendees to ask any questions of our esteemed panelists. I mean, while we got them here, it captured in their Hollywood Square. If you have a question, you know, please be sure to drop that in the chat or to raise your hand and ask a question of any of our panelists. I've been watching some of the chat, some of the comments in the chat, and people have really responded, and a lot of what has been stated and discussed has resonated, and also with the additional input from some of our participants. So as stated, if you have a question, please drop it in the chat or raise your hand. Also with comments, of course, the same there. And this is your opportunity to ask any questions, or as I said, provide any additional comments for our moderator as well as our panelists. So we'll pause here. And this is also an opportunity if you have any questions for Rachel, or any general questions that you might have in the last couple of minutes that we have on today's call. But again, certainly thank our panelists and thank our moderator as well. And thanks to Rachel for providing that great overview of the resources that are in AspirTracy. And Kate just dropped in the chat that they have some resources on their website as well. So please make sure that you capture that information if folks are reading the chat. Also, we'll make sure that we share information as well following this meeting, along with the recording. So I'm not seeing any additional questions or any additional comments, but you can certainly keep them coming. You know, always you can send any comments or questions that you may have to our hpp@hhs.gov resource mailbox. And Dr. Cunningham has also provided information about how you continue to engage. So really appreciate the time of our panelists, as well as our speakers for today's call, and also your willingness to continue to serve as a resource. But I want to thank also the audience. I mean, for those that are participating on today's meeting, for your active participation, really appreciate, as I said, all of the comments that have been dropped into the chat. Just a reminder, you can share any stories regarding how you are using ASPR funding to make a positive impact in your communities. And if you have a story to share, please fill out the Stories from the Field submission form or reach out to your project officer for more information. And a member of our team is going to drop the Story from the Field submission link in the chat for reference. We certainly look forward to hearing about the great work that all of you are doing. Again, want to thank our panelists, our speakers, our moderator, and especially all of you. And we hope that everyone has a great day. So thank you very much.